You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Last month on Inauguration Day, President Biden signed the Executive Order on Preventing and Combating Discrimination on the Basis of Gender Identity or Sexual Orientation. Women across the United States and around the world reacted with anger. This meant, they feared, the erasure of women's sex-based rights. But the language and impacts of the order are difficult to decipher for a layperson. In order to clarify, I spoke with Lauren Adams, legal director of Women's Liberation Front, WOLF, a U.S.-based women-only organization dedicated to the total liberation of women and girls. Here's that interview. So, thank you for joining me today on the show. I'm really looking forward to talking to you and to learning more about what's going on over in the U.S. right now.
Yeah.
Very recently, now President Joe Biden signed the Executive Order on Preventing and Combating Discrimination on the Basis of Gender Identity or Sexual Orientation. And I understand that this directs agencies to enforce federal laws that prohibit sex discrimination to include discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. That was a very long sentence. Can you explain what that actually means?
Sure. So you kind of have to understand the role of the federal agencies too. Congress passes laws, and it is up to the executive branch, via the administrative agencies, to implement them. And the way they do that is, first of all, by creating regulations. So the best example and the most relevant example is that they passed the education amendments Congress did to Title IX, which said that there could be no discrimination on the basis of sex in education. And that's what the law said. And then Congress said to the Department of Education, make some regulations around sports to make sure that that both sexes have equal opportunity. And then the Department of Education, 40 years ago, came back and said that we can have female-only sports teams. And the reason they had to come up with a regulation saying that is because there is a presumption that you can't discriminate. And that means you can't choose one or the other favorably. And so they actually had to carve out an exception to the discrimination law in order to provide equal opportunity in athletics to female athletes. So the reason that's a really good example is because that's one of the things that is directly affected by the executive order, and it's highly contentious right now in the U.S. in general. So with that overview, basically what this does, there's the Department of Education, there's a couple dozen agencies, actually. There's the different departments, and it's all the way down to, you know, the Office of Women's Health under HHS or things like that. And it basically says, number one, the federal workforce now has to implement this anti-discrimination protection in this way. And that's more immediate because that's something that he, you know, being sort of in charge of the federal workforce, he can say that. And then the second part of that is, like you said, it directs these federal agencies to, so he gave them 100 days to review all of their anti-discrimination regulations and the statutes to ensure that there is compliance with the order. And he specifically cited the Bostock versus Clayton County decision from last year, which is our Supreme Court addressed a case where, which basically said that, I mean, essentially it said you can't be fired or not hired for saying that you identify as transgender. That wasn't quite the facts of the case, but that's what they ultimately said. And our concern at the time was that it was going to be interpreted to allow access to opposite sex facilities and opposite sex sports teams. And unfortunately, that turned out to be a correct prediction because it immediately happened. And now it's happening in this way. And so what each agency has to do is they have to review all of these and within 100 days come back with a plan to either add new regulations, change or clarify existing regulations, or revoke regulations. And the executive order doesn't really give, like, other than the deadline, they don't give a format. They don't say, we need you to return a report and say this and this and this. It just says you got to come back with a plan. So it's a little bit fuzzy, and it leaves a lot of room for that to come back in any format. It also leaves a lot of room for them to start doing things pretty immediately. And we already know, based on Obama-era kind of guidance that was given, that he said he's going to adopt other things that he has said on the campaign trail, things that his cabinet nominees have said about these issues. We already have a really good idea of what kind of stuff they're going to start to do in the different areas. It's just a matter of when they come back and start doing it. And so we're keeping a really close eye on it so that we can be able to take action accordingly. But the other thing I was going to mention is that even though the order says that they're supposed to apply this court decision in terms of anti-discrimination, they were very, very careful not to say exactly what they meant. And we think it was a very sneaky and intentional way of phrasing it. So a lot of times on the campaign trail, and you hear advocates speak about it, ACLU, where they'll say that trans kids deserve to play on sports or do whatever in accordance with their gender identity. And we were actually surprised not to see that language in the executive order, but he does say it was something about how it was children deserve, you know, to go to school and be able to go to the bathroom and be able to go to locker rooms and play sports. But that was all. So the implication, we feel intentionally to the general public, is that there's these kids who are going to school and identifying as transgender and are being told they can't go to the bathroom or go to the locker room or play sports, which is not happening. They're just being told, you know, if you're a male student, you can't play on the girls' team and, you know, you have to do things according to your biological sex. And we also feel that, you know, in that specific example of bathrooms and locker rooms, we, in order to comply with that regulation, you really only need to provide a reasonable third space. And a lot of schools have tried to do that and, you know, give kids who don't feel comfortable using their own single sex facilities, you know, like a, you know, gender neutral unisex kind of single occupancy stall. But they've challenged those too and said that they're stigmatizing and have won those, the right to sort of communally shower with the opposite sex based on self-declared identity. So that's kind of the overview there.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of stuff that I want to follow up on.
Sure.
I don't know even where to start. Are there actually in the U.S. like a large number of boys, male students, let's say, who identify as transgender, who are wanting access to restrooms and locker rooms and they don't have access? Like, is this a verifiable problem that exists that needs to be addressed?
That's interesting because I don't think we can know the scope of it for a number of reasons. One of which is that these things don't usually end in like litigation and things, they're resolved at the school. I'm sure that there's a lot of students who identify as transgender who are perfectly content to use, like, you know, a single occupancy stall if they're uncomfortable. Or at some of these more progressive type schools, maybe they're even just comfortable going to the facilities according to their sex. Like, maybe, you know what I mean? Like, kind of what we would like to see, where gender nonconforming kids are, you know, well accepted within their sex. But In terms of sports, yeah, it's hard to say because they do make, and there is some evidence, the common stat is like something like 0.6% of the population identifies as transgender. And we have seen a lot of other data that shows that the younger generations are way more likely to identify as trans or non-binary or something else. I think the CDC said 3% of millennials, and then GLAAD did a study from a couple. GLAAD is the formerly was known as the Gay Lesbian. I can't remember the rest of the acronym, but it's basically it was a gay rights organization, and I think they said it was up to 10% identify as something other than cisgender. Do you know what I mean? So obviously that's not all trans, but it's certainly something that's culturally been more prevalent in the younger groups. So I think also we can't necessarily look to historical kind of how much of a problem is this, because this is a sort of a new generation. We're entering new territory. And we do know that we hear a lot of people say, oh, well, they're not displacing female athletes and, they're not winning. They're not out there winning. But we do see that they are. There's a case in Connecticut where there was a girls' track and field team, and there was two male athletes who did not distinguish themselves on the boys' team in terms of performance, and the next season played on the girls' team and won between them, I think, 15 titles and broke some state records in speed for the girls. And this was very, very upsetting to some of the female athletes who came in like third behind them and things like that. And all the sort of advocates had to say about it was, well, they didn't win every meet kind of thing. But really, you're talking about things where girls are getting cut off from the ability to win, in an area that's supposed to be, and losing those scholarships. And so we do know some of those high profile cases. There's been some other ones, not at the school level of like breaking world records and things like that. It's really hard to know, especially also because every state has different policies in place. And so it's hard to know once the dam is broken, like how it's going to affect it. But we predict pretty big results, especially because the ACLU, they don't argue that they're behind a lot of the litigation and a lot of the advocacy. They don't say this in court or in their documents, but behind the scenes, they create like materials for distribution in K-12 schools that tell schools that it's actually inappropriate and possibly illegal to force male students to take hormones in order to compete with females. And so another common talking point you hear is, oh, well, after they're on estrogen for a year, something, something, like it reduces capacity, athletic capacity. But we actually find that the same people who are arguing that are behind the scenes arguing that it should be purely self-ID. And they're making statements, I can send it to you. They're making statements like things like sex segregated sports are based on like paternalistic, condescending ideas about women's abilities and things like that. And this is endorsed by the National Education Association, which is our largest teachers union in the US. So it's re the scope, I'll say you were talking about the scope of the problem, but I think the scope of the advocacy is just absolutely massive, more than people even know. And I think if they succeed in making self-ID in sports, I think we're going to see a huge problem. And just to be clear, too, I don't think one of the other things that people will commonly critique is they say, well, no one's identifying as a girl just to go and play on the, girls' sports teams. And, we're not saying they are. Like, it can be true that someone very sincerely has this view of themselves as the opposite sex. And also be true that it's inappropriate to make exceptions to sex segregated sports, especially when there's issues of safety or fairness. And so I think that, yeah, I don't think we're going to have an epidemic of like boys pretending to be girls or anything like that. It's just that you know, gender identity is not relevant to the reason that we have sex segregated sports, which is based on average physiology.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because you hear that all the time. You know, people frame my arguments around gender identity in that way. They'll say, like, oh, you know, Megan Murphy says that there's, you know, people going around lying about being transgender in order to access women's change rooms or women's transition houses or, you know, to play on girls' sports teams. And it has nothing to do with lying. You know, I don't necessarily think that people who identify as trans have negative intentions or are trying to manipulate people. It's just that it's the effect is a problem. It doesn't matter what you believe about your transgender identity.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and going back to the idea of the sex discrimination, too, is that I'm not really familiar with, you know, Canadian law, but in the U.S., we have a very strong presumption of anti-discrimination on the basis of sex. You have to justify, the government does, the government has to justify pretty thoroughly why they can ever treat male and female people differently. And so that's in the context of sports, but it's also illegal to discriminate on the basis of, at least there's some case law in employment, at least on the basis of stereotyping. So there's been cases where a woman was denied a partnership. It was a case called Price Waterhouse, and she was denied a partnership because she didn't dress feminine enough. She was too aggressive, and she sued her employer. And the employer argued, well, we have other female partners, and we also have, you know, basically that there's male partners who have these same things. And so being an aggressive or a masculine person is not disqualifying, neither is being female. But she was for those two things. And so the court ruled, I think correctly, that she was discriminated against for being insufficiently feminine to them. And that's illegal. That's not a permissible way to sort people. And so actually the argument that we should say that the way someone views themselves, or if a person is gender nonconforming or has an affinity to stereotypes of the opposite sex or has a feminine or masculine presenting appearance, the idea that we should use that as a basis for segregating, for making these like very rare distinctions that are when biology is, it just doesn't make any sense. Because you know what I mean? Like how somebody chooses to make their appearance and do all these things is just not relevant to these very, very rare instances in the law when we can treat men and women differently.
Right. And so as you mentioned earlier, this order is, you know, it's said to be connected to the Bostock versus Clayton County decision, which I don't totally understand that connection because, I mean, can you explain what that case actually was? What happened there?
Yeah. And this is really funny. I followed, this case was from before I joined Wolf. And so I was a civilian when this was passed, and I just, you know, they reported on the news. Oh, they said you can't fire someone for being transgender. And that's kind of what I thought was the case. And it wasn't until I actually like looked more into it once I was hired by Wolf that I found out that that's not even the facts of the case. What happened there was the plaintiff who worked at a funeral home, which had a sex specific dress code, which had, you know, different professional standards for their male and female employees, which are legal under Title VII, which is our employment anti-discrimination statute. And the plaintiff said that they were going to begin, you know, dressing according to the feminine dress code. And the employer said, no, that's, you know, that's not okay. I'm not going to do that. And they parted ways. And they were sued, essentially saying that not allowing an exception to the dress code was discrimination based on gender identity. And this was interesting because the courts could have come back and said, you know what? Sex-specific dress codes are crap. and they're illegal and we no longer support them. You're right. Men should be able to wear dresses. If women are able to wear dresses, it's not fair. And they could have come back and had this great, wonderful feminist ruling that was really good for everybody. But instead they came back and said that if that sex dress codes are okay, but if a man says he feels like a woman inside and wants to wear a dress, that they can make exceptions only for that type of person, but not for a man who's like, well, I'm a man, but I just want to wear a dress. You don't get to wear a dress, but you do, you know? And so it's like kind of this weird carve out, but they had to do it by creating like a transgender status is I think the term that they used. So they also specifically said, because obviously they anticipated that there was going to be concerns about this from a number of angles. And they said, they even said in the decision, this does not, we are not addressing sex segregated bathrooms. We are not addressing dress codes, which is hilarious because they were asked to address dress codes and they just didn't. And they also said this does not address Title IX or any other federal statute. So they went out of their way to say this is only limited to hiring and firing, that like discrimination. You cannot, you know, basically that. So anyway, so it's really strange for an executive. It's also not surprising. I should say strange, but expected that he would come out. It's one thing if he had an executive order that said, hey, you know how this decision said it applied to hiring and firing? You need, hey, you Department of Labor, you need to have some Department of Justice. You need to have some regulations that make sure you're enforcing this. That would be one thing. That would be consistent with the opinion, and that would be consistent with logic and common sense and morality of saying people should be able to not get fired, right? But for him to actually go out of his way to talk about bathrooms, locker rooms, school sports, and Title IX, it just shows a willful misunderstanding or just ignoring actually what the Supreme Court said and what they laid down in their decision. So we take that as a very negative sign that he specifically invoked Bostock in that, because it's his big signpost. You know, they always like to say we're using dog whistles. That's his dog whistle of saying, like, what we mean is that people get to choose the way that they're treated in terms of what sex they're treated as. So everything is self-ID. And we have a lot of, you know, I brought up education and sports because that's in the news a lot right now. It's gaining a lot of attention. And it's also just one of the more easier kind of ways to get your head around how this whole process works. But we're very concerned about the impacts on really the most vulnerable women, you know, and we're looking at shelters, which get federal funding, so they're covered under this, prisons, just all of these different things, all of these like adding misgendering to harassment policies and things like that. And, you know, it's America, we have a lot of religious people. And so there's a lot of women of Orthodox religions who, even beyond privacy, they have rules that they follow about nudity and the opposite sex and in being in intimate spaces and actually telling women that you no longer have a guaranteed access to single sex showers or places like that actually serves to exclude these women from public life, which in my opinion is also a violation of like the First Amendment freedom of religion, because you're saying that, you know, for some of these women, it's a lot of like Orthodox Jews or Muslims or even some more conservative Christian things. And these are women who may already have other challenges to access to public life. And so to actually say that there's no way that you can have any privacy unless you're in your own home, you can, you know, and so we expect also other rules. There's the Health and Human Services, they put down rules about affirmation-only care, so you'll be able to sanction. We assume these are coming, right? Like, this is not, the executive order tells agencies to make these rules, and we know what he's asking them to do, and one of them is, like, that you won't be able to ask for, or you won't be able to know that if you ask for a female nurse during an intimate exam, that you're actually getting a female it'll be a self-identified female, because hospitals won't be allowed to discriminate based on gender identity and all sorts of things. We're seeing huge implications in the schools. It's very, very serious where they've now, some schools, there's lawsuits going on because schools have been hiding gender transitions of children from their parents. And they have official policies on how to do it, on how to take notes in a way that circumvents federal law so that they don't have to tell parents. And the schools are allowed to make their own determinations as to whether the parents are a danger to the children in terms of their transition without even bringing in CPS. So there's no, you know, and just this bullying stuff where, like, if you're a girl in the locker room and a boy comes in and you say, hey, you're not supposed to be in there, you're get out of here, you're a boy, and he possibly for the first time in his life says, no, I identify as a girl. From that moment, he is protected, whether or not he is sincere or not. The ACLU also tells schools not to inquire as to the sincerity of the stated gender identity. And the girl in this scenario could herself get in trouble for bullying and harassment if she refuses to say that this person is a girl, based on, even if the day before he said he was a boy. And so people kind of point to us as extremists of like, that's not happening or that's not going to happen. But, you know, I'm an attorney. So what I look at is it could happen. There's nothing in the law that prevents that from happening. So what you're saying is we're not protected from that happening. And we know that not all men, but men who do choose to victimize women, who are perpetrators, will take whatever loopholes they can get to gain access to violate and torment their victims, basically. And we already know that schools and the military and all those other places are hotbeds of that stuff. And it's just very paradoxical that the group that's always trying to promote women's rights, and they talk about rape culture and they, you know, all that kind of Me Too, all that stuff. And then they're the ones who are like, no, your boundaries are bullshit.
So the language in the order talks a lot about children. So it says children should be able to learn without worrying about whether they will be denied access to the restroom, locker room, or school sports. To me, it gives the impression that this is about kids, but how, you know, but this affects women too. Is that right?
Yeah. And men deserve privacy in naked spaces too. I mean, but obviously we care about the people who usually need more privacy, right? But they talk about children because they think it's going to be, they know that people care about kids, and so they're thinking about these poor children. But they also worded it in such a way as to make, if you didn't know anything about any parts of this debate, you would think that these kids are like literally getting kicked out of bathrooms mm-hmm. because they don't look how they're supposed to look or whatever. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that was really intentional because they wanted to avoid really bringing controversy into the text of the order itself, is my guess. Women, we're very worried about. So right now in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and as you know, the U.S. has an extremely high percentage of our population incarcerated compared to almost any other country. Mm-hmm. And that includes women, who make up around like 7 to 10%, depending on the state or federal. And right now, under Trump, there was a policy of you just had to go by the birth certificate. And I've been not quite able, I'm not an expert on this stuff, so I could get some of it wrong, but from what I understand, it's just birth certificate, which I assume means if you've had it changed, then it could go based on that. But essentially they're not sympathetic to the, I need to be in the opposite sex housing argument. And before that, it was really kind of iffy. Like, it wasn't self ID, but it also wasn't banned. And what we are taking from this executive order, that's one of the areas in which we expect to see one of the more dramatic changes, is in prisons in terms of switching over to self-ID. And we have very serious concerns about that, obviously from a safety perspective, but also because it's going to be one of the places that's the most hard to get information out of. So it's really, really hard to tell if you want to advocate for people who are incarcerated what's going on unless you can find them a safe place to talk to you or get information from the people who are around them. And we've seen how some of this is playing out too. So California, as of the first of this year, just implemented self-ID in their prisons. And their regulations specifically say that, and that's in their state prison. So when I say what Biden's doing, that's federal prison. So if you are convicted of federal crimes, that's where you go. But in California, they have it now where they are explicitly in the regulations not allowed to consider anatomy, whether there has been any medical treatment, whether they have legally changed their gender, whether or not they appear sincere. You're not supposed to question it. And there's all these FAQs in there, and they have, well, how does the department determine if someone is transgender? And the answer is, well, the department doesn't determine it. The person tells us. And it's like, what kind of autonomy are you giving people in this one specific area, but you're taking all autonomy away from everyone else in prison in every other area? It's just a very strange dynamic. And we're very worried because, especially, we have this new information from the UK, which I don't know if you saw this, but they came out a couple of weeks ago and said, oh, the number of female pedophiles has doubled in the last 4 years.
Oh, my God.
And yeah. And they mark crimes based on self-ID. And so there's all this thing in this article that was like, are people feeling safer about coming forward about female sex offenders? And like, maybe. And if so, good. Like, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But also in the same time period, they found out through Freedom of Information that 38% of the female sex offenders in UK prisons are male, in women's prisons are male. So, yeah. And obviously they should make up only what, like less than 1% if it's proportional. And there's been famous cases like Karen White, where we know that people who maybe don't have gender dysphoria, but have some sort of paraphilia. And we're just, so when we say self-ID, we're just providing no protection at all and no oversight. And in California, someone we spoke to who's an advocate who works there says that he has not even been able to get clarification from them on whether they will be marking them down as transgender inmates, which means if they're just saying this is a woman, we may never be able to get the data on what happens with this switch in policy, because there will be no data on all of these things. And New York is trying to do a similar policy, and there's some concerning regulations they've already gotten into. For example, we have something, a federal law called the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and it places certain requirements on both state and federal prisons about safety procedures and data collection that they have to do regarding sexual harassment and sexual assault in prisons. And New York decided to make intentional misgendering a form of sexual harassment, which is subject to recording under the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And so what that also means is that since they started doing that a year or two ago, we're going to be seeing data showing an increase in sexual harassment of people who identify as transgender in the prison system, because now saying, you know, using sex-based pronouns or whatever is going to be classed as sexual harassment. And that's going to be continued to be used by advocates to try and keep with mixed sex prisons based on gender identity as opposed to single sex prison housing. So we're very concerned about a lot, all these different pieces coming together. I would say just for me personally, too, the things I work on, prisons, it really gets to me because anytime you have that or hospitals or shelters, anytime you have somewhere where people can't leave. And that to some extent that applies to school, too, because, you know, you're required by law to be there. You have to go every day. But yeah, we're really concerned. Data collection, prisons, schools, hospitals. We're concerned about this, what this all means as well for, you know, they call anything but affirmation only care. They call that conversion therapy for gender identity. And we're very concerned that there's a lot of gay kids who, because, you know, gender dysphoria, most kids grow out of it. And a lot of the kids that do grow out of it to be gay. And so we're concerned that there's same-sex attracted young people who are dysphoric and they're getting caught up in this affirmative care decision and they're putting them on hormones and basically sterilizing them. And so there's just so many broad reaching impacts. And I think what we sort of expected him to do was something with Title IX. And then he came out and said, actually, we're doing this with everything. So it's sort of, it shouldn't have caught me by surprise, but it actually did. I don't know why, but it did.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because, people will say like, you know, why would a trans person go through all this effort, you know, go through all this surgery, like bother, you know, changing their lives to such a big extent just to, again, like trick their way into prison or, you know, female sports or whatever. But the reality is that what is being pushed is self-ID. And I think that's the primary concern, to be honest. Like, I didn't really see feminists. I mean, certainly I didn't really think about this issue very much until we started talking about, you know, transgender simply in terms of identity. Like, you can just say you're a woman and you have to be accepted as a woman. You know, in the past there was a process to legally change your so-called sex, you know, on documents and things like that, but it was a pretty major process, and, you know, I don't recall really seeing much fuss about that. But it's this thing where it's like, you're male and you announce you're a woman or you a girl or female, and that's that. That's, you know, the law. That's what's being pushed right now, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Self-ID. I mean, there's concerns about all of it, right? But I think self-ID is the thing that presents the most, that aspect of it presents the most immediate danger and potential for abuse. Because like you said, people aren't, you know, actually going through medical procedures and things like that to try and get in places. But also, I mean, and I'll say this in the context of, you know, I think people also get really sensitive to the idea that transgender people are, like they're being called perverts or deviants or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, it's almost sort of the backwards way of looking at it, because we're not saying anything about anyone's gender identity. It's male people of whatever gender identity. We don't have any data or statistics that would suggest that they are somehow not a part of male pattern violence. That there's, I haven't seen any studies that show that they're less susceptible to violent crime than any other male person. So it's not so much that, like, you know, we're not, that's what the people say, oh, trans people aren't a threat to, trans women aren't a threat to cis women, or however they put it. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I don't know that that's true, because I don't trust your definition of what a trans woman is. Mm-hmm. And if it's just anyone who says that they're a woman, and there's no reason to think that they behave any different way, same physiology, same socialization, And so, yeah, there's a lot of concerns about that. And if, you know, I was thinking the other day too, that if women presented the same level and type of threat to other women as men did to women, we would be structuring our public accommodations very differently.
Mm-hmm.
There would not necessarily need to be single-sex accommodations if there wasn't this differential in both likelihood of perpetration, ability to successfully perpetrate, consequences of perpetration in terms of pregnancy or anything like that. If there just wasn't these differences, we wouldn't need to have our own spaces and our own things, but we do. And just, yeah, it just goes back to the idea of if we are choosing to segregate or separate something by sex, there's no reason why there should be exceptions to that based on stereotypes, right? Like, why are we letting men kick feminine men out of manhood? Like, you know what I mean? Like, why do they get to just decide who, you know, like, just own your stuff? Like, let's open this up and say that, you know, there is no feminine or masculine hairstyles or clothing, or let kids play with what they want to play with, and don't force them into boxes or force them into having no boxes. You hear these parents who kind of say that, you know, because a lot of these parents are enforcing this too. You don't have a lot of parents complaining actually about these bathroom situations at school and stuff. They're getting urged on because they've all been kind of told that this is the way to go, in terms of, like, otherwise you're bigoted, you know? They're mm-hmm. getting re-educated, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, initially, one of my concerns, and the concern expressed by a number of feminists, was around the fact that Biden had said last fall that within the first 100 days of his presidency, he was going to pass the Equality Act.
Mm-hmm.
So is this order connected to the Equality Act?
So, yes. Well, yes. This order implements some of the worst parts of the Equality Act, with none of the good parts of the Equality Act. Well, I shouldn't say that. Sexual orientation. See, this keeps getting forgotten in these conversations, right? Like, we're also focused on how outrageous this other policy is, that it's almost like there's no room to be celebratory over the anti-discrimination protections for LGB people.
Mm.
But I would like to take this moment to celebrate that. But, yeah, according in terms of the Equality Act, so there's a couple, obviously it's connected in the sense that it does a lot of the same stuff, the same provisions in terms of, it has the same interpretation of the fact that sex includes gender identity, the fact that this means someone should be treated as the opposite sex on their word. And it also, so it does a lot of that same stuff. Some of the key differences are that it's a different process. So if legislation is passed, then, which was what the Equality Act would be, you can't have regulations from an agency that overturn it. And either Congress or the executive can always say to the agencies, like, this does not actually. So, like, if they were to do something that Congress felt violated the spirit of some law, they could actually just pass a new law and overrule them. Whereas you can't do the reverse, right? So if Congress passed something that, you know, they said wasn't something that they wanted to do, it doesn't go in the reverse. So legislation is a little bit more permanent. Obviously, that can also be overturned either by courts if it's unconstitutional or by a later act of Congress. So the regulations are a little bit, I'm not going to say shake your ground because they're lawful, right? But they're more subject to change. And there's a whole process for that too, the rulemaking process. So you can do a petition for rulemaking or as an external, stakeholder, or they can choose to start their process for rulemaking internally. And they have to do this as part of a public process. They have to give notice. They have to give opportunity for public comment. And then they make their decision about rulemaking, and they kind of issue their new rules and justification for why they chose it based on evidence and everything. And that whole process, in order to then be revoked, it would have to be Congress. They would either have to revoke it themselves, or Congress could say, no, we're overruling that. Which there's not a separate process for Congress to overrule that. That would just be they're passing a bill and it kind of makes that moot. The other thing that agencies can do, and this is happening without the Equality Act, this is happening without an executive order, is they kind of just do these little guidances, these guidance letters, or they'll do memos, or they'll do things, and it's very like under the radar. It's just kind of like a, hey, by the way, this is how we're interpreting this. And it's very easily challenged. Like it's subject to challenge, but you also can't, you don't always know that they're doing it exactly the same way. And it's really hard to overturn because it puts these cultural things in motion too. That's the thing. So like all of the employers in the US, right? They saw this executive order and they know that what's coming down the pike is regulations from that are going to have to do with not only hiring and firing, because I'm sure some of them started getting that squared away last summer after the Supreme Court ruled, but they're probably anticipating, oh no, we're going to need to address this bathroom issue, the locker room issue, if maybe there's a locker room there, or all these other things. And they're going to start to put these policies in place. And even if it doesn't ultimately happen, like if we're able to successfully challenge some of these policies, or if they go a different direction, like if the agencies decide that they are not on firm legal ground on some of these, all of these employers are still going to have to be on the safe side, started to implement these other things. And that's just an example. I mean, this is, so there's an impact here that's hard to quantify as well. You know, every time you have like the government signaling something, you have people doing their risk assessments and trying to do that differently. And I think that that's one of the unfortunate things right now with having not clear direction, with the direction just being come back with a plan, that we could see some impacts like that, especially because we have such a huge network of well-funded advocates like the ACLU and the HRC and all of those. All those other ones who are doing this stuff underground and have the relationships with lawmakers, have the relationships in industry, and they're able to just, they have a ton of influence.
I wonder if you, I mean, this would maybe be speculation, but maybe not. Maybe you have some idea. Do you think Joe Biden knows that this order will have a negative impact on women and girls, or do you think he just doesn't have any idea and he just thinks he's doing something good for the LGBTQ community?
It's impossible to say. But I do have some speculation about it, despite the fact that it's impossible to say. It's tempting to say that he's like super old and has no idea what any of this means. Especially because you see this with the federal judges when they're ruling on this, and you're like, why are you saying this stuff? And then my theory on that is they have these like young woke clerks who are like explaining to them how sex is now a spectrum and whatever. And with President Biden, do you know who Sarah McBride is? Sarah McBride is a close family friend of the Bidens.
Oh.
And is a close friend, it's either of his daughter or his granddaughter. I feel like I can't remember the family tree. But so while my instinct would say he just has no idea what he's talking about, I do wonder how much sort of family influence is there. And he's so far removed from having to deal with any of the impacts of this. And there's nobody who has his ear, who's telling him about any of it. And do you think he's like Googling stuff? Do you think he's like on Twitter himself, like reading radical feminist tweets? I just don't think he's ever heard it. Did you catch in the town hall his answer to that mother with the 8-year-old transgender child that she said she had?
Remind me.
Oh, so she was like, what are you going to do for my daughter? You know? And he was like, I'm going to change the law. And then he starts telling a story about how when he was a child, which was back in the 1700s or whatever, he saw two men kissing on the street. And his dad was like, sometimes two men love each other. And I was like, this story never happened. And this never happened 80 years ago. But also, it has nothing to do with this woman talking about her transgender child. Like, what are you? And so that's when I was like, does he have any idea what he's talking about? He doesn't. He can't, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is. Sorry, go on.
Oh, no. Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, it's revealing to me when people do conflate, and everybody does conflate sexual orientation with gender identity. You know, all of this gender identity legislation that's being proposed or passed in Canada, in the US, in the UK, not all of it, actually. In the UK, not so much. But a lot of this legislation, I should say, and of course, when people talk about the issue of gender identity, they talk about LGBTQ. So they talk about gay people, and they talk about trans people as though it's all one and the same. And so, you know, it is very revealing when a politician responds to a question about transgenderism, about gender identity, and starts talking about, you know, like, gay rights and people shouldn't be discriminated against because of who they love. They do that in Canada too, right? You know, like, our politicians here right now are debating, I'm going off on some other tangent. They're debating Bill C-6, which is a bill that bans conversion therapy, and they've lumped together sexual orientation and gender identity. But, you know, the politicians will talk about it and say, you know, love is love and love wins, and like, people have the right to love who they want to love. And you're like, this has nothing to do with gender identity at all. And I don't think you have any idea what you're talking about because of what you've responded in this way.
Well, yeah, no. And that's totally true. You're right about the politicians, and it's completely compounded by the fact that they're all surrounded by people who are either have drank the Kool-Aid or are afraid to say that they didn't drink the Kool-Aid. You know what I mean? No one is advising them otherwise. And we've been dealing with this thing too, just talking about self-ID and how people don't understand what it is. One of the other executive orders he talked about or that he did was overturning the quote ban on transgender soldiers. And it's been interesting because we've had some people come out and say, oh, well, you know, I hate most of what Biden does on this issue, but I support overturning the ban. And the thing is, he was never banned. They were never banned. And
it's funny. I'm glad you brought this up because we hear about it a lot. And to be honest, I don't understand. So,
okay.
Thank you.
So,
go on.
And you have to forgive people for thinking there was a ban because President Donald Trump went on Twitter and said he was banning them. So it's not like it came out of nowhere, right? Like, we literally have this tweet where he's like, they're no longer going to be able to serve. But here's why it wasn't a ban, which is that if you actually look at the regulations, it said that people with gender dysphoria, which they did an impact assessment and they found that it has a very high rate of complications for a mental health condition, and mental health conditions are disqualifying, serious mental health conditions. And as advocates always say, there's a very high risk of suicidal ideation in people with gender dysphoria. And the Department of Defense actually found that military service also increases suicidal ideation. And so they made the determination in 2018 that it was an unacceptable risk to a soldier's mental health to have them enlisted if they have gender dysphoria. And they didn't kick anybody out. They just said they weren't going to take new soldiers. They also said that anyone who had like I can't remember the exact phrasing, but basically a history of dysphoria such that they would need to, the language was basically, if you don't have a serious mental, you know, possibly incapacitating mental health condition, and you're not taking hormones and you're not expecting us to pay for, you know, a mastectomy or a castration or anything like that, then you can come and serve with your biological sex. And because they consider that to be, like, advocates consider that, you know, oh, you might, I guess we can't serve then if we can't serve with our preferred gender. So they called that a ban. And I know I'm not really explaining it that well anymore, but basically it was that they actually, I mean, because you can't, you literally can't be in the military if you have, like, you can be disqualified for, like, endometriosis. Like, I think I read a thing today that said something like 70% of the American military age population is ineligible for service based on, like, their really high standards. If you're too short, you can't be in the military. Like, you literally, it's like you can't. And so they turned it into, well, you're banned if you're transgender. But it actually specifically says that people who identify as transgender, as the opposite sex, are not barred from serving. So it's just that if they have these other things and they have to serve with their sex. And I mean, so things like, you could say, I identify as a woman. You can use opposite sex pronouns for yourself. You can, you know, within the Army's grooming standards that, you know, are pretty Spartan and apply to everybody. You know, there's nothing that says you can't, like, wear women's clothes or whatever when you're not in your Army greens. And so it's not that they're asking people to, it's not like don't ask, don't tell, where they're asking people to be in the closet. It's just literally related to the medical aspect of it. And so we've been dealing with this, like, the last couple of days, where people are really confused. And like I said, Trump can take a lot of that blame, but also it's an intentional thing, the way that they've framed these debates. They're banned from women's sports. They're banned from the military. And in this context, banned just means I didn't get exactly what I wanted. Like, I didn't, this didn't meet my needs the way, but there's no right to serve in the military. And if there was, all the people who are discounted based on diagnoses of depression or things like that, or, you know, if you had like an accident and if you're a man and you had an accident and you have missing your testicles or your penis, you can't serve regardless of gender identity. Like, there's these disqualifying things, and they're just asking for special exceptions for if you have these mental health, you know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know. Sorry, I went off on a tangent there, but.
No, that's a really interesting. And like I said, I'm actually glad that you brought that up, because I've really had a hard time getting my head around that particular issue in the US, because people talk about it a lot in terms of discrimination against transgender people. But in any case, I mean, so back to the order, I mean, people have said to me that, you know, this is something that's easier to fight than, you know, say if Biden had passed the Equality Act, so we shouldn't, like, freak out. I mean, what can women do in the U.S. to challenge this?
That's a great question. And one of the things, the first thing I'll say is that we are keeping really close tabs on it and formulating different strategies depending upon what happens first, you know, which agency comes back with something or doing different things. So we have an action on our website that's where you can send a message to President Biden, and we threw Vice President Harris in there too because she's a woman, so she should care. But basically it says, please, please, you know, revoke this executive order. And we don't, you know, obviously expect them to have this great change of heart, but, we want them to be hearing from us. We need to just stand up and do that. But we are also going to be having specific actions related to different things that come up. If there's a petition for rulemaking, or if they announce that they're going to start interpreting a rule in a certain way. And we've got people tracking each thing at each agency, just the way we do with state legislation and with litigation. We're keeping a very close eye on it, and people are going to hear from us with more. And we're working on all of that. And I would say you can, you know, just to plug us, you can start by following us on Twitter or signing up for our email list as well, because we will be communicating that way. And it's really hard to see how this wouldn't end in litigation. I mean, it certainly will. It's just a matter of how. But all of, for us, all of our options are still on the table. And we've got this 100-day period. They're confirming all of the nominees in the Senate, and they're going to get going and get started. And we're going to be in communication with them throughout this process, too, making sure that they're doing impact assessments on women and other impact assessments in general on everybody for any policies that they're changing. And we're keeping an eye on it. I would say, you mentioned people saying it's easier to fight this than the Equality Act. And I do think that that's true, because the only way that you can fight legislation that's passed is to, you know, sue over it. And, you know, and there's several bases by which you could do that for something like this. But it's the same thing here. So part of it will be pressuring, also putting pressure on lawmakers to act and to say, you know, to get in. And we've got a lot of state level stuff going on, too. So there's all of these Protect Women Sports Acts. There's one federally. It's been introduced in the House this session. And we have a bunch of different state level ones that are in various stages of getting passed, probably. And that's going to affect it, because if you have a state that says, hey, we have a law that determines that sports can only be based on biological sex, like that's how you determine women's sports. But then you have the federal government saying, well, actually, we're interpreting it this way, and it says that you can self-ID into the sport. You're going to have a conflict there, and you're going to end in litigation there. And there's going to be more than one state who probably, if the Department of Education does decide to come back and say, you know, sports is based on gender identity and not sex, then we're going to see a lot of lawsuit when that happens. But we're trying to sort of we're going to be proactive about that. That's probably all I can say about that right now, but things are going to move very quickly. Don't know if that was very clear.
No, it was very clear. And I appreciate you explaining that. I mean, it's always confusing with legislation, and, you know, people, myself included, don't really understand not only the language, like legalese, but, you know, I'm in Canada, so I don't understand the American process as well as I do the Canadian process. And I think it's just generally complex for people. America is really confusing, like you say, because it differs from state to state, yada, yada, yada. But in any case, what I had wanted to say was, you said, follow you guys on Twitter. So that's Women's Lib Front on Twitter. Is that right?
Yes.
And then,
while we're still there.
Lucky you. Be careful, watch out for Jack. But and Wolf's website, of course, is womensliberationfront.org. So everyone go to the site, follow them on Twitter to learn more about how you can fight this, because it's really important. And thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
You just heard an interview with Lauren Adams, legal director of Women's Liberation Front. To learn more about their organization and to support their work, visit womensliberationfront.org. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen: iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.